I'd like to say to the people that are still out there, if you think there's no hope, if you think there's no way out, give yourself a chance and push through whatever hard time. You have to pick up the phone and you have to contact somebody that has been through and has made it out of something you're going through. It's just like starting a new job. If you don't go to somebody that's already done that that job before, you're not going to be able to figure out how to get it done. So it's very important to not contact a friend or even a loved one because they don't really understand what's going on with us. We're different. But we're different for a reason. You know, there's always hope. You have to take the first steps. That's it.
You're listening to Real Recovery Talk with your host, Tom Conrad. Every day, Tom helps guide people like you who have loved ones dealing with addiction. You're most likely frustrated with the situation, worried your loved one won't get better, and concerned you're not doing enough to help. This show will help you understand the tremendous struggle of addiction from your loved one's perspective. You'll hear stories of recovery, which will give you hope, and you'll understand the limits to what you can and can't do to help those you love. Tom is a certified addictions counselor who's successfully winning his own battle with drug addiction and alcoholism and has helped many others win theirs as well. It's time now for Real Recovery Talk.
Here we are, Real Recovery Talk. I am your host, Tom Conrad. In today's episode, we have somebody that is currently in our treatment center. We don't do this very often, but when we do, it's quite an amazing experience. We have Tony here. Tony has been in Rock Recovery Center now roughly 3 weeks and has 31 days clean today. Is that right, Tony?
That's right.
All right. So first thing is first, go to realrecoverytalk.com. There you will find every single episode that myself and Ben has ever recorded. There's some 150 episodes there, covering everything from drug addiction to alcoholism to food addiction to sex addiction to shopping addiction. Addiction is addiction, and it's all treated the same way. But if you know anybody that is struggling with addiction, or you yourself are struggling with addiction, scroll those episodes, see what sticks out to you, listen to it. And if you have any questions, comments, or concerns, call us, reach out to us. You can email me at tom@realrecoverytalk.com and ben@realrecoverytalk.com. Ben is not here. Ben is, I don't know where he is, but who cares? We have our guest here, Tony, and Tony is blessed us with his presence and has volunteered to share some of his story on the podcast, and hopefully you can get something out of it. And I know he has quite the extensive story, and he's going to talk about that and hopefully resonates with all of you. So here we go. Tony, how you doing?
Good.
So we chatted a little bit before even starting the podcast, and you're 37 years old. You're from Detroit?
Yes.
All right. So take us back to the beginning when Tony was just a little boy. What I want you to do is talk about when you started your journey of experimentation with drugs or with alcohol. How old were you, and what was that progression like as you got older?
Well, I guess to start, the childhood I had, I kind of grew up in foster care off and on as a result of my mother being an addict. So I can remember, running away from one of the group homes that I used to be at, and just kind of on the street with the guys that had ran away that day. And I remember the first time I took a drink out of a 40. We were all passing it around, and I don't know if I liked it, but it kind of I did notice that it got me out of myself. Like, you know, it made me more comfortable with my surroundings and what was going on at that time.
How old were you?
I was 17.
So tell me just a little bit about your go before that. You said you grew up in like in foster care?
Yeah, at some point. I mean, I my parents up until I was about 16. So my mom was an addict. She had alcohol and drug problems. My dad was the one pretty much that held the family together. He didn't do anything. So I guess I can remember them splitting up, my mom packing us kids in a back of a truck, and we at this time my dad had a house that he paid for our family in Virginia, and we were all in Virginia. And one day he went to work, and when my dad went to work, my mom loaded all of us kids up, and we actually took off to Michigan, where my mom's sister lived. So I remember, you know, they kind of split up at that point. So at that time, living with my mom, it wasn't a normal childhood. My mom was always in and out of the house. My oldest sister was pretty much the one who was taking care of us. We were living in the streets of Detroit, rough area, and, you know, my mom was just in and out doing her thing, not really being a parent. My aunt did live down the street, and we would go and visit her a lot. But, you know, my aunt had her own children that she was trying to raise also. So after that, that point, I remember a little while after, my dad actually moved back down or to Detroit to be with my mom. I guess they were getting back together. So it was about a month, and they were together at this house we lived in Detroit, and things seemed to be getting better. I do remember my mom still going out, but my dad was there, which made it, you know, it felt a lot better. So Christmas Eve, my dad had asthma. He had an asthma attack, and he passed away on Christmas Eve in 92. And so, I mean, that was rough. So I went back to my mom trying to raise us the best she knew how. And my dad's side of the family kind of stepped in and seen what was going on. And I have an older sister. I have a brother who's 26, and I have another sister that's 1 year older than me, 28. And we all got split up with different family members on my dad's side. And I went with an uncle. My other brothers and sisters went with uncles and aunts. But I was the only one I went with an uncle. And it was a big change for me, because as far as my mom and her side, with my mom being white and, you know, my dad being black, it was a different kind of lifestyle, like a big change for me, because there's different rules, there's different things that they want it done. It was just a lot more stricter, and it was nothing like growing up with, you know, my mom and her side of the family, which I was so used to there. Even my father, he's like universal. He doesn't, you know, stick to one script. He really wasn't even, real close with his side of the family for a while. I don't know why, but with my uncle, that was different. He was real strict, pretty much, anything I did wrong, I got a whooping for, but it wasn't like a regular whooping. It was like a beating. He had a temper problem. And one day we were at my grandmother's house. He came in with a girl, his girlfriend, and went to my grandmother's room. I don't know what they did, but came out. My grandmother came home and asked who was in her room, thinking that us kids were going through her stuff. And we're like, no, our uncle was. And she confronted him. I went to take a shower, and I can remember him coming in the bathroom, sliding the curtain open, and slapping me in the face while I was in the shower. I was about 16 then. So I got real angry, pissed off. And after that shower, I got out, didn't have a destination where I was going to go, but I walked right out of the house. My mission was to find my mom, because at that point, they weren't really letting us contact our mom, which was the only parent we had left. So they were kind of holding us back, and I missed her. So I went, somehow got on a Greyhound, found her in PA, and Was staying with her for a little bit, a couple months. Got enrolled in school. Started kind of feeling a little more comfortable, but again, she still wasn't in the house. I was pretty much taking care of myself. And then one day she came home, basically came home just to rest and eat and, you know, recuperate for a couple of days. And she was headed back out again. And I told her, if she goes out, I'm going to go with her because I want to make sure she comes back home. And she's like, all right, I'll come back. You can come with me. So I walked with her. We caught a bus down the street, basically to the hood. And we got to this bus stop. She's like, wait at this bus stop. I'll be right back. And, I'm going to do what I do. I'll be back. So I waited at the bus stop. It was about an hour and a half went by. I got up and, started walking around looking for her. I remembered a bar that she used to go to. So I went to that bar, went inside, asked if they seen my mother. And they told me no. They locked the door behind me and called the police. And Child Protective Services got involved. From there, I was taken to a group home. And I stayed there for about 2 weeks. Another big change, something I wasn't used to. And that's where I ran away from and drank alcohol for the first time.
So there's obviously a lot there that you shared. And it's kind of one of those things that, like, normally I wouldn't have somebody talk for, seems like you spoke just now for 7 or 8 minutes, but it was one of those things where I'm kind of like, I'm as you're talking, I'm picturing what you're going through. Right. And it's really, so what I heard was basically a dysfunctional family right from the get. Right. Was your dad addict or alcoholic or anything, or not really?
No, not that I know of. If he was, I never seen it.
Okay. And your dad was white or black?
Black.
And your mom was white?
Right.
And your dad passed away when you were 7 from an asthma attack. Your mom was a drug addict from the time that since you can remember.
Correct.
When your dad passed away, you went with uncle. Right. Uncle was very abusive, didn't really have much care for you at all. Your brothers and sisters went with other family members, and you ended up with your uncle at 16 years old. He essentially beat you up, and you said, F this, I'm out.
Right.
You went and found your mom in Pennsylvania and went to a bar, she invited you with her, like, while she was going to go cop drugs or whatever the case was.
Basically, and didn't really take me exactly to the spot, but she had me wait at a bus stop and she walked to do whatever she was going to do.
Okay.
And never came back to that bus stop.
And so you go and search for her and then end up getting intervened on by Child Protective Services. You go into a group home and you're there 2 weeks, you leave, and now you get introduced to alcohol. How were you introduced to alcohol? Did you kind of take to a different group of people? Like, walk me through that.
I guess it, like you said, I took to a different group of people, but I took to that group of people because those were the group of people that were actually willing to run away and leave and had the same idea I had. So that was really the main reason I was, leaving with those guys.
Before the podcast, we were just chatting a little bit, and you had talked about how growing up, one of the hardest things for you to deal with was really having a black father and a white mother, and being mixed, you didn't really know which way to go or... explain that. Like, what was the actual struggle there, especially in the times of today? You know, there's obviously a lot going on with racial, racism and stuff like that. How did that play an effect on you even way back then? Because you're what now, 37?
Yes.
So what was that like for you growing up?
Basically, when my mother and father were together, I didn't see any of that because, my father wasn't like that. My mother wasn't like that. But when we got split up and I was actually with my dad's side of the family, my uncles and all them. So basically when I was with them, the part of Detroit we lived in was all African Americans. And, you know, me being light skin, of course, they talk about everybody for everything when you're in school. But the thing was, when I went to the black schools, I was, you know, the cracker, the white boy. When I went to the white schools, you know, I was the black boy, the whatever, you know what I mean? That started, that's pretty much what started that, kind of trying to figure out where I fit in at. Because I didn't know anything about that at that time until that happened. And I was put in that, you know, pretty much segregated school of color, or, you know, when I was with my mother and we were on that side, our schools were mixed, but mostly white, you know, the area she lived in.
Whereabouts in Pennsylvania was that?
We lived in, Pittsburgh for a while, Monroeville.
Did we discuss this before or no?
I think you brought up something about, Pennsylvania, Cranberry or something.
Yeah, I grew up in like Newcastle area, just north of Cranberry.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So once you got out of Child Protective Services, you're experimenting with alcohol. Where does it go from there? Take me now into the progression. Like, what was it like? When did you get introduced to drugs and stuff like that?
So the group home thing, you know, I was in and out of group homes, different ones, foster family, stuff like that. I continued to run away. You know, each time I would either go find my mom or I would go to a cousin's or something like that, and stay with them. And they would let me stay there for a while. And then, you know, Child Protective Services would intervene again or find out where I am and take me back. So that went on and until I was about 18 and I aged out. I was actually on the run when I aged out. So I guess I lived with a cousin for a long time, got into carpentry, really wasn't doing any drugs, but we used to drink on the weekend. That was like the thing to do. And I guess at that time, drinking with my cousins, because I looked up to them because, you know, I was really close to my cousin, and I was working with her husband and learning a new trade and stuff like that. And, you know, I was just felt part of, you know, to sit there and drink with them. So I guess also with the same cousins, I mean, staying there, in that household in general and with her husband, he had his views of black people also. So I experienced the racism again. And he would make comments and stuff like that. And he knew what I was. And, it wasn't so much in directly to me, but it was, you know, that's how it was. And, you know, my cousin didn't say anything. And, you know, it was just like, well, what's the right way to go? You know what I mean? And, you know, a lot of things were said like, you know, you have to be this certain way to be successful. So I was real confused growing up. So from there, I remember working for a while, with him, just drinking on the weekends. I eventually moved out, moved on my own and, started basically working out. That became my thing. I liked it. It was a stress reliever, a way out from things. I was in my own little zone. I didn't have to worry about where I fit in at that point. So it was comfortable, and I really got into it, and I did it a lot. So I got into bodybuilding and stuff like that, experimented with steroids, and got a job at a strip club as a bouncer. With a friend of mine, and I still wasn't into drugs. It wasn't my thing. And I worked at this club for a while and things were going good. I was making great money. I was still going to the gym and, you know, I actually felt like I had a reason to be big now because I was bouncing. And I just remember kind of, getting wrapped up and involved with the girls that worked there. And most of the girls that worked there were on some kind of drug or alcohol or something like that. And I remember basically setting up an after party, and a couple girls went, and we were all drinking. And then somebody brought out cocaine, and so my buddy was doing it. He said, try it. I tried it. I guess I really didn't like it the first time because I got real sweaty, stuff like that. I was very uncomfortable. But I drank more alcohol in it, and it went away. That went on off and on. There were the parties like that. And it was really almost like night and day, like instantly almost, to where I enjoyed it. I liked that excitement. I liked that. I liked the intention I was getting. And it was sort of like, all right, now this is where I'm supposed to be at. This is my scene right here. So that was powder cocaine and alcohol. And it hadn't become a problem at that point. It was just whenever we went to the parties and you know, maybe on the weekend. So that's where that got started at.
So when did, because I know you came in, when you came into treatment, it was for opiates.
Yeah.
What happened there? How did you get onto the opiates?
So at the same parties, there were Vicodins introduced, and I was enjoying sort of the cocaine, but I didn't, once I tried, I took one of the pills and it like kind of mellowed me out, and I still felt like I was, you know, fitting in. I kind of left everything else alone and started doing like Vicodins and stuff like that. So the pain pills went on, it got worse to Roxy's, moved up to Oxy, and that went on for many years, just the pills, all the time.
Were you getting prescriptions written for you, or were you just buying them off the street, or what?
Buying them off the street.
And what were you doing? You were working at the strip club like the whole time?
Right. Yeah.
How long was that period, would you say?
I worked at that club for about 6 years.
Okay.
And eventually the club found out, you know, that the dealer was coming there to bring me pills, and I eventually got fired from that job for that reason.
So when did just the wheels start coming off for you, and it just started becoming like, I mean, you know, when addiction, it crosses that line to where it's something that we're able to do, we're able to function, we're a functioning addict. It's something that we can do on a daily basis, and it's still fun. But at some point in time, you cross that line to where it's now a job.
Right.
And you're just doing what you have to do to get your drug.
Right.
When did that happen for you?
So that happened for me when I started experimenting, because I wasn't getting the feeling I wanted, when I started crushing the pills up and actually shooting the pills. So that at that point, the shooting it was a different euphoria. You know, that's something that when I first, you know, I was all into health and working out and stuff like that, something I was totally against, but I started letting my, you know, walls down at that point. And then when I realized that if I don't have it, I'm going to get sick, and I felt like shit. So then it became something that I needed as opposed to just wanted. So the pills ended up getting really expensive. I couldn't afford it. It was hard to get. I didn't have a prescription, nothing like that. And, someone mentioned somebody that had something that felt the same way, which was heroin. And, I tried that, and it was much cheaper. It gave me the same effect, but 10 times, you know, better, stronger. And I started shooting heroin and sniffing heroin and kind of, I don't know. I was able to work for a long time and hide it from a lot of people. So I ended up moving to another state, to North Carolina. And I was working, and I had a warrant because I was selling used cars and I didn't have a dealer's license, and the police got involved, and I had some rigs on me and some heroin on me, and the police, they found the rigs, they didn't find the heroin. So I ended up getting locked up. I got out the next day and said I was going to go to, you know, a treatment center and do all these things, and actually I got on Suboxone, and that really didn't help me much at all. Got on Suboxone for a while, eventually just went right back to the heroin.
How long were you on Suboxone?
For about 3 weeks.
Okay.
Yeah. But it didn't, I was still feeling, you know, shitty, and it was just at that point in my life, I wasn't ready to give it up. You know, I still had thoughts of using heroin again. So I continued to use heroin. I lived in North Carolina, ended up losing my job I had, ended up homeless, and on the streets of Charlotte, North Carolina for a long time. It was before I came here, it was consistently off and on for the past 4 years, were pretty much the worst days of my life. Being out there, I experimented with crack. That was the first time I was kind of introduced to that homeless, people that were out there doing that for years. And, it was hopeless. It was almost like, hell on earth, really. I mean, there was all kinds of stuff that was going on that, you know, you really don't see unless you're in that scene. I just continued to medicate and, you know, I felt sorry, for the things that were going on, and I just continued to use. And I was at that point not working. So I was doing crazy shit like stealing from stores, stealing from people, doing pretty much whatever it took to get the next high again. And that was my low point. I never OD'd or anything like that, but there was a few times where I would either be driving or just in one spot and I wouldn't know how I got to another spot, or I'd be driving and end up on the side of the road and sleeping, or I'd wake up with my car ran out of gas. I don't even know how I got there. But I am a firm believer in God, and I believe that he intervened at that time and did what needed to be done for me not to, leave this earth at that time.
So I wanted to bring this up just briefly because I know you're a man of faith.
Right.
Where was this throughout? Like, is this something that is new to you, or have you been a man of faith for a while? And if so, like, where was this during your addiction?
So, my father was a firm believer, in the Lord. And, he used to read to us, take us to church. For the most part, most of my family were, we were going to church and stuff like that. But at that age, that was something that we just had to do. You know what I mean? I really didn't understand too much about it. I didn't really start seeing the Lord work in my life until, the points where I was alone, the points where there was nothing that anybody, a friend, family member, human, anybody on this earth could help me out of or change certain situations. And things like that happened. And he continued to show up in my life at certain points, even throughout my addiction. And at that point, through my addiction, I became, I everything I had read, everything I had heard in church, I knew it was real. I knew that he was definitely, out there.
So to some people, that sounds like total hogwash.
Right.
And to other people, they can totally relate. I can totally relate. I can look back at everything that I have gone through in my addiction. And I grew up in a Christian household, too. It was more imposed on me. But nevertheless, I consider myself a Christian, and I grew up in a Christian household. So I consider when I got sober, I was ahead of the game in the sense that I already had a concept of spirituality. I had a faith that I believed in and I continue to believe in. But some people, they're not there yet. And what you just said, they're like, no way, this isn't possible. And my addiction proves that.
Right.
What would you say to that person?
I would honestly say that, there's a point to where you have to give up self-will. There's a point to where when you realize the facts of certain things that have happened to you, that there's definitely a higher power that intervenes that has to change that situation. There's no other way to explain it. For me, that's exactly what happened. I mean, I've literally ran into people in my worst of times, you know, basically contemplating suicide, and actually ran into a complete stranger. And I've always had the thought in my head of, you know, if God was real, why doesn't he do what he does for so many other people, which is completely take that taste and that thought and you know, picks them up from where they are and puts them somewhere else, as opposed to me having to continue to go through this struggle in and out, you know. And that was a problem for me because I always prayed, even in addiction. I prayed. I thought about God constantly. And, you know, this particular guy that I ran into at a bus stop, just random, you know, asked me how I was doing. I said, fine. And he, just asked me if I believed. He didn't have a Bible or anything. He just asked me if I believed in the Lord. And I said, yeah, I do. And he's like, he said, if you had a question or if you had any questions or doubts about anything about, you know, Christianity or the faith, what would your question be? And I told him, you know, I'm like, why doesn't God just take this feeling out of me? You know, this taste, this thought, everything that's going on and change it like he's done to so many other people. And the guy told me, you know, which I didn't have anything to say. He said, you know, God's all powerful. We don't have answers. We don't know why God does what he does. But this I can tell you. He says there's people like us. Later on, I found out that he was in addiction and you know, was recovering addict. But he said there's people like us that are, you know, have to go through certain things to help other people, to offer experience, you know. Because if nobody goes through that, then you really don't have anything to talk about. You can't touch on a subject that you know nothing about or you haven't lived. And it made sense. I mean, it made sense, you know. And I don't always believe that it's pain and suffering, and God puts that on you. I just believe that that's your testimony. That's you're here to either help somebody else, or you know, bring somebody to the faith and explain how real God is.
I think you did a really good job at explaining that. Now, do you feel like that's something that you're being drawn towards now? Like, are you of the mindset, especially now being in treatment now for 30 days, roughly, do you feel like that is something that is more what you're being drawn towards? And like, I've gone through all of this because I'm really supposed to be doing this. Is that kind of where you're going?
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely. And the feeling I have now, well, let me say this. For a long time, I've kind of wanted to, what they say, like ride the fence. I wanted to, you know, serve God and do other shit on the side. And there's always been a problem with that. I always end up on the worst side. You can't do both. And I came to the decision that I'm just going to, you know, put 100% in it and do everything in my power to serve him and to do what's right and to live different and just see what happens. And I've done that, you know, just being here, getting outside of myself, having this conversation with you. This is something I normally wouldn't do. You know, I'd always be worried about what somebody else was thinking of me, and I didn't want to tell my story because, you know, that's not me. And I try to put on this front and this mask. So, you know, I look like a different person. But now I'm so genuine and passionate about, what I believe and what I've went through and the changes and the feelings that I have now. It's almost like I'm living a new life, and I'm proud of, where I've came from.
There's a lot of people again that hear that and they think to themselves, well, it must be nice to be in that position, you know, to learn so much about you. But I'm in this position, Tony, to where I'm using heroin on a daily basis. I don't know what to do. I wish I was in your position right now, being able to go to treatment or to have some sort of faith. But right now I'm in a position to where I can't. I don't know what to do outside of using drugs. What do you say to that person?
Honestly, I would tell that person to pick up the phone and get in touch with somebody that, they know that has been through what they've been through and isn't living like that anymore, and get some kind of advice from that person. Because, you know, like me, you could pray to God and apply that, but you might not get pulled out of that situation immediately. There's some work you're going to have to do, and it's not always going to be easy. And I know for me, I just had to continue to push through those hard times and those times where I felt like, you know, the times that made me want to go and get high, the thoughts, the feelings, the withdrawals, whatever it may be. At that point, you have to push through that and go and get that help, or go through that sickness and just continue to do what's right. And things will definitely begin to change, and you will definitely appreciate that effort you put into that.
Yeah, there's in the big book, they talk about we would not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. And I think to me what that means is everything that I've gone through in the past, I've gone through for a reason. And I never want to shut the door on that, because that's who I am today. That's who that's my identity. Now, I don't go around wearing "I'm an alcoholic" on my t-shirt or anything, but it is part of my identity. But because I have gone through that, and I think that you would have the same mindset, because I have gone through the things that I have gone through, makes me who I am today. And there's people out there that has gone through pretty close to your situation. I tell everybody, circumstances are different. You know, I'm not biracial. You're biracial. I grew up in a broken home. My mom bounced when I was 2, you know, and I've only met her twice my whole entire life. So we have that commonality.
Right.
There's a lot of different things. I mean, heck, we grew up, it sounds like, 30 miles from one another. So we have things that we're in common with. But the most important thing that we could relate to on many, many, many levels is addiction. We're cut from that same cloth. And so everything that you have said has resonated with me. And if I told you my story, which I will do, you would resonate with everything that I would say.
Right.
And so when you say pick up the phone and call somebody, a lot of people would say, well, okay, let me look to my closest friends and my closest relatives or whoever that can identify with me and knows me, so on and so forth, when it's not really that. Just find somebody that's cut from the same cloth.
Right.
You know, anybody that has suffered from addiction or alcoholism, or has suffered with their faith and they don't really know, you know, how I can even utilize my faith to get through my addiction. Because when we're in addiction, the last thing, at least for me, that I was thinking about was, how can God get me through this? I wasn't thinking that. I was thinking about, how did you even put me in this situation? I wasn't really reaching out to him to get me out of it.
Right.
You know? Yeah. So I think, dude, for, you know, your story, I think, is very impactful on many, many, many levels. What are some of the things that you've learned about yourself just in the past 30 days and being in treatment? Like, we all have kind of these revelations when we're, you know, remove the drugs and the alcohol, and here we are.
Right.
Like, all the emotions are real. You know, we feel again. What are some of the top things that you've learned about yourself throughout this 30 days of sobriety, and kind of what do you hope to achieve in, say, the next 30 days?
So I guess the first thing that I noticed and I was really surprised about was I always thought that I needed something to live and try to somewhat be normal. I always thought I needed something, whether that be a buzz from Suboxone or, you know, whatever it may be. And I'm past that. I know I'm happy now. I feel good. I don't need any kind of, you know, any kind of boosters or anything like that. I do have the strength, you know, everything comes back. You know, I'm motivated. but the main thing is, even now being able to talk, and explain what happened, in my story and, you know, how things are changing really, helps me to find out and realize that I don't have to have any secrets. I can be open. And then I begin to, you know, notice that, it doesn't matter where I'm at. I'm able to, you know, fit in anywhere. I don't need a drug. I don't need to be high or buzzed or anything like that. Because I'm comfortable with myself and who I am. And I've come from a place, to where I can offer strength and hope to other people. And, you know, if they don't like it, that's fine. If they do, that's fine too. But I am biracial and I can go into a room, of all black people and offer my story and tell and have something to say. And I can go in a room of all white people and say the same thing and have something to say and, you know, impact some people. Some people might not care. Doesn't matter. Or go in a room that has all kinds of races in it. So the main thing that I really appreciate is being able to find self, to realize, who Tony really is. And, you know, everything that I went through was for a reason. There's little things, there's certain things I used to do that I noticed that come up sometimes and I have a tendency to do it. Like I've went to a store, before and did some little slick shit, like put something on a counter, put a bag on top of it, paid for one thing, walked out of the store with the item, you know, got down the street, felt like shit, had a conviction in my heart, knew it wasn't right, knew that that would be the start of some other bullshit that might be hidden, and turned around and took the thing right back and, you know, told them that I didn't pay for this and paid the guy for it. And that for me was important because I got that uncomfortable feeling at that point. And that reassured me that I'm doing something right. Because normally I wouldn't care. I'd be like, yes, I just saved some money. I got away with this. I'm good. And it felt good, you know, and, also being able to share my story and help somebody else, volunteering, you know, whatever it may be, talking, if it's financially, if it's, you know, just taking the person to the gym or having a walk with them or something, is really rewarding to me. It's a good feeling. You know, not being so much in self, also giving my will up and, you know, in the mornings doing my prayers, you know, realizing that I'm not really in control. You know, God's in control. He decides what happens. As long as I continue to do what the book says, things are going to go the way they're supposed to go. And it's working, and that's what I continue to stick with. Now in the future, honestly, I'd like to continue to do the same thing as far as speaking and offering, you know, strength and hope to other people and volunteering in any kind of way. That would be my main goal, honestly, in life, because I get so much enjoyment out of, you know, just letting somebody know that it doesn't always have to be like this. You know, if you apply certain principles, things will begin to change eventually. It might not happen right away, but eventually it will. So I really don't like to think too far ahead, but that's the main thing. That's what I'm passionate about. And I've realized that it doesn't matter what you have or how much money you have. If the inside isn't right, the rest of it isn't going to be right. And that's what I stay focused on today.
The one thing that you said there that I just want to take a minute and stay on is that word conviction. And I think that is a turning point for a lot of people. Once we start feeling conviction, now that, again, it's easy for us. We're men of faith. But I don't necessarily think you have to be somebody of faith to have this, what's called conviction. Right. I mean, I think that's just being a good person, having morals and ethics is going to cause you to have conviction. Now, in our addiction, conviction isn't really there.
Yeah, we don't have morals.
That's kind of good. There's no conviction in addiction, right? But when we get sober and we start doing all this stuff through the therapeutic process, through having solid dudes in our life that are sober, we're doing the right things, we're progressing. I remember the first time I had that feeling of conviction when living in the sober living environment, and it was kind of the same thing as you. I didn't take something, but I knew I didn't get charged what I was supposed to be charged. And that, I felt it. I'm like, you know, this isn't right. And I did the same exact thing, and I went back there and I made right by it. And that was a turning point for me. You know, and I think when people start experiencing that, that's when we know we're on the right track. If we never start to experience that and we're just still trying to live dirty,
right,
but without the drugs and without the alcohol, something's not clicking. And I think that's something very good that you picked up on and that you pointed out. I think it's very important that a lot of people don't talk about. Dude, I think this has been a great episode. I appreciate you sharing your story. I think that, you know, just talking about like what you want to do in the future and helping people and speaking and stuff like that, there's so much opportunity to be able to do that. Hence why I even started this podcast. I don't know the majority of the people that listen to this.
Right.
Yesterday, I'm on my way home from work and a guy shoots me an email. I've never spoken to him ever in my life. And he wants to have a phone conversation about his recovery. And I call him up and here he's listened to just about every episode that's come out. And he's like astounded that, you know, I'm actually on the other end of the phone, like I'm some sort of celebrity or something.
Right.
But it's cool because it's impacting people that I would never have been able to reach.
Right.
You know, and so there's many ways that we can do this, and through podcasting, through just volunteering other places, sponsoring guys, you know, just being somebody that being available to people.
Right.
That is going through what you're going through or what you have gone through, being available to them to help them out. And I think, dude, you're on a great track, and I think you're honestly killing it, man. And I appreciate you coming on and talking.
I appreciate you giving me the opportunity.
Is there anything else that you want to say that you would say to anybody or anything before I stop recording? Or
I'd like to say to the people that are still out there, if you think there's no hope, if you think there's no way out, give yourself a chance and push through whatever hard time. You have to pick up the phone and you have to contact somebody that has been through and has made it out of something you're going through. It's just like starting a new job. If you don't go to somebody that's already done that that job before, you're not going to be able to figure out how to get it done. So it's very important to not contact a friend or even a loved one because they don't really understand what's going on with us. We're different. But we're different for a reason. You know, there's always hope. You have to take the first steps. That's it.
And in the end, if you need some help, you just send me an email, tom@realrecoverytalk.com. And Tony, you know what, man? Thank you so much for coming on to the show. I can't wait. This will probably go out in the next couple of weeks, so I'll make sure to let you know. Okay. And that is it. So thank you for tuning in to Real Recovery Talk. Make sure to go to realrecoverytalk.com. There you will find every single episode that we have ever recorded, and Tony's is going to be on there. So don't forget to go there and reach out to us if you have any comments, questions, or concerns. And that is it. We will see y'all later.
You've been listening to Real Recovery Talk with Tom Conrad. If you'd like to have a confidential conversation about your specific situation, give Tom a call on his direct line at 561-220-7163. Or if you'd prefer, you can chat with Tom live at realrecoverytalk.com. As always, if this show is a benefit to you, please give it a 5-star rating and review in Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, or wherever you discover your favorite podcasts. Thank you for being part of our mission to bring hope and healing to our loved ones struggling with addiction, as well as wisdom and comfort to those of us around them.